Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 18th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, End of Diversity Plan Causing Student Exodus from Waterloo Schools. A new state law that bans schools from denying students from enrolling in other public districts in order to maintain demographic diversity is already having a significant impact on some Iowa districts with large minority populations. Almost 140 students, nearly double what the state's legislative analysis agency projected, have requested to open and enroll out of the Waterloo Community School District, school officials said. Waterloo has one of Iowa's largest minority populations. In Des Moines, nearly 300 students applied for open enrollment before the March 1st deadline, and another 95 have applied since the law was changed, school officials say. And in Davenport, more than 100 students have applied for open enrollment, but 9 of them under the new law, school officials said. Those numbers will be celebrated by supporters of the new state law, who say it allows all students more choices in which school they attend. The law's critics note the enrollment changes will leave behind higher concentrations of students with heightened learning needs and from low-income backgrounds. Before the new law, 5 Iowa school districts, Davenport, Waterloo, Des Moines, West Liberty, and Postville, could reject requests for open enrollment to other public schools if the student leaving would diminish a district's diversity. The law, approved earlier this year by the Republican-led legislature and signed into law by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, banned diversity plans. Hundreds of families across Iowa are already taking advantage of the new law, and far more than expected in some districts. As of Thursday, the Davenport Community School District had 219 applications to transfer to other district for the 2021-2022 school year, 117 of which were for family preference, school leaders said. Had the voluntary diversity plan still been in place, only 9 of those transfers would have been approved unless the families chose to pay tuition, officials said. The district also is attempting to contact the families of another 29 students who applied but had their requests to transfer denied under the diversity plan. These applications are being retroactively approved unless a family changes its mind. School officials expect the majority of those families to send their children to another district. Another 73 applications are classified as continuing enrollments, which means the families are moving to Davenport but want their students to stay in their former district. The district said this was higher than expected and could indicate decision-making based on the reputation of Davenport schools. Of the 131 transfer requests for which the district had demographic information available, 70% were white students and just 8% were black, according to the school data. The district's student body is 53% white and 20% black. Davenport Superintendent T.J. Schneckloff said the new law is what it is. He said the district is attempting to offset the transfer's impact by highlighting the education services and opportunities for students to succeed that it offers. What we're going to do is we're going to make Davenport the destination of choice, Schneckloff said. The only thing that we can do is move forward and make Davenport the place to be, and that is what we intend to do. Schneckloff said transfers could also create financial issues for the district, which budgets for an expected enrollment figure and could wind up with a significantly different number, he said. He could not provide a dollar amount for the financial impact of the transfers or the forecast what the final enrollment number will be, but that the district will need to be able to forecast that impact in the future. If you anticipate what the enrollment in and enrollment out is, it's much easier to budget for. And so in the upcoming years, we are going to be monitoring that very closely, Schneckloff said. And now here's a subheader that says Waterloo Impact. The end of voluntary diversity plans has led to larger exodus of students from Waterloo Community Schools than was initially predicted. The Legislative Service Agency estimated this spring that 75 students would request to open enroll out of the district this fall if the law changed. However, since Reynolds signed the bill into law in May, 136 requests to open enroll out of Waterloo schools have been made, according to the district. And because the legislation includes no application deadline for the coming year, those requests could keep coming. Superintendent Jane Lindemann, she said that she met with Reynolds about the concern. They didn't intend for it to be an open-ended date, she said. I've talked with them 3 separate times about it, and they are definitely monitoring the impact. Typically, the deadline is March 1st to apply for open enrollment, but the bill banning diversity plans extended it. Waterloo School's diversity plan required equal numbers of students from a similar family income level to open enroll in and out for requests to be approved. They made it more difficult to leave or enter its schools compared to with surrounding districts. As of Wednesday, 12 different school districts were represented in the requests to open and roll out of Waterloo schools. District officials said 89% of the 136 students are white. By level, 87 of the requests are the elementaries, 21 at the middle schools, and 28 at the high schools. It's definitely skewed towards our littlest learners, said Lindemann, noting the district's open enrollment requests are generally weighted towards our early elementary grades. Proportionally, it's very heavily skewed towards our kindergarten class. That can be seen in the 29 Waterloo Schools open enrollment out requests accepted Monday by Cedar Falls Community Schools Board of Education. 9 requests were for kindergartners, 5 for first graders, and 4 for fourth graders. 1 to 3 requests were for students in the other elementary grades, along with 3 sophomores and 1 senior. The Cedar Falls Board denied 15 other requests to open enroll from Waterloo Schools. All but 2 were for students going into 7th through 9th grade. Cedar Falls Superintendent Andy Patiz said those denials related to capacity limit at the district's 2 junior high schools. The other 2 at Cedar Falls High School were denied due to program needs. Along with those, 44, Waterloo Schools officials said that they have received 4 other open enrollment out requests to Cedar Falls, and 7 of the total are for districts' virtual learning programs. Officials from other districts said they have so far accepted all the requests received for open enrollment out of Waterloo Schools. Before getting confirmation from Cedar Falls Schools, Waterloo administrators said 79 of the requests to open enroll out had been approved by other districts, while 6 had been canceled. Along with the Cedar Falls denials, 7 requests to open enroll into Waterloo Schools have softened the impact on the district. Originally, there was another open enrollment in request that was canceled by the parent. 6 of the remaining requests have been approved, with administrators still working on the final one. Waterloo School officials said the second highest number of requests to open and roll out was to Hudson Community Schools, at 29. Hudson Superintendent Tony Voss said the district school board has approved 28 requests, with at least 3 more on the agenda for this week's meeting. "We've got capacity right now, so we're not turning anybody away at this point," said Voss. "We're wondering if there's going to be another run before school starts. That wouldn't be particularly surprising if that does happen." He was uncertain if the district would be able to take more open enrollments after the school year started. "I'm sure we'll take it on a case-by-case basis," Voss said. Now let's move on to the article, "Colorful and Whimsical Murals Create Informal Gateway to Downtown Waterloo." Shawn Elizabeth Tyler is used to people shouting at her. Sometimes it's a bike rider rolling by on the sidewalk. A few curious onlookers have pulled over, stepped out of their cars, and ventured up to ask Tyler what she's painting on the sides of buildings at 329 W6th and 325th West 5th Streets. "It happens all the time. Most people have been really nice and interested in the murals," said Tyler, a University of Iowa Master of Fine Arts graduate student. "The murals are being painted on a pair of buildings parallel with the frontage road along Washington Street and visible from the U.S. Highway 218 overpass. Inspired by Iowa's natural landscape, prairies, and native plant species, the welcoming paintings are meant to serve as a gateway into downtown Waterloo, according to the Waterloo Exhibitions, Collections, and Public Arts Committee. The project is a partnership between the City of Waterloo and the Iowa Initiative for Sustainable Communities, a program of the U of I Office of Outreach and Engagement. The Waterloo Center for the Arts has been working with U of I MFA students in the College of Arts and Art History to design and install the public art murals meant to reflect the values, stories, and identity of Waterloo. U of I lecturer and 3D design artist Hannah Givler leads the course in public art. Tyler's designs were selected for the project and work began July 6th. Murals should be completed by Tuesday. Tyler chose a vibrant palette of blue, orange, yellow, and purple to represent the downtown's sense of energy and renewal. Her whimsical motifs incorporate goldenrod, butterfly, milkweed, and groundnut vines from Iowa's prairies. I love working with botanicals, flowers, and even my houseplants because the form feels so natural to me. I'm from Oklahoma, and when I moved to Iowa, my first apartment was near a bike trail, and I saw tons of goldenrod and other wildflowers. It referenced the prairie, which again is natural to me. I wanted to pull from those things, the artist explained. The mural at 329 West 6th Street is nearly finished, except for a preserving top coat of clear varnish. It represents sunset, while the scene at 325th West 5th Street represents dawn and daytime, and is still a work in progress. It's about two-thirds done, about to the point where I can come down in the evenings and superimpose my design onto the wall with a projector and then sketch it out. These are my first murals of this size, and it's a cool challenge. It's nice to stretch a different muscle. Tyler typically works with textiles in addition to painting. She has surrounded flowers in each mural with pollinators, bumblebees, and even fireflies because they are pollinators too, Tyler said, and act as a visual echo of the glowing moon. Each mural exists independent of the other, but together form a complementary and complete scene. She is being assisted by fellow U of I MFA students Niles Foster, Kyla Rump, and Lachlan Hinwood. The artists are applying Nova Color acrylic paints supplemented by house paint using brushes and rollers. Each mural has three layers. First, a gesso layer that prepares the surface to hold paint. Next, a radiant layer that captures the light and provides glow. Then the design layer, and finally a protective top coat. We use Nova Color because it stays on the wall really well and keeps its color. These are west-facing walls and get lots of light. You want the mural to last, Tyler said. Now on to a different article. Dyke, New Hartford, father and son killed in barn collapse. Two people were killed when a barn collapsed in Cedar Falls on Friday night. On Saturday, the Dyke, New Hartford school district sent a letter of offering condolences to families affected by the loss of the two people killed in a barn collapse, according to a Dyke parent who received a copy. The letter identifies those killed as Andy Kaufman and his son Beckett, who is about to enter fourth grade. The courier was unable to confirm the letter refers to the Cedar Falls barn collapse. Cedar Falls Fire Rescue was dispatched to 9702 Viking Road at around 6:30 p.m. Friday for a response to traumatic injuries. Dispatch advised that a barn had fallen on two male subjects, according to a news release. After arriving on scene, firefighters were told there was possibly two people in the barn when the roof collapsed. Bystanders said they hadn't been able to get a response from those trapped in the rubble. During the recovery effort, two victims were found obviously deceased, the release said. Fire officials determined the victims died instantly in the collapse. Authorities have not yet confirmed the victims' names. The letter signed by Justin Stockdale, superintendent at Dyke New Hartford, states, "This is truly devastating time for our Dyke New Hartford community. We are all trying to work through our feelings of shock, grief, and trauma." The letter goes on to advise the district will have staff and counselors available from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday at the Kruger Hemmen Sports Complex to help students and their families deal with their grief and share memories of Beckett. Now on to the article, Pence, Noem, Lament State of the Union at Iowa Christian Conservative Event. The past 7 months under a Democratic administration have made the America of previous 4 years unrecognizable to the political speakers at a Christian conservative event held Friday in Des Moines. Former Vice President Mike Pence, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo were among the speakers at the Family Leadership Summit, the 10th annual event hosted by the Family Leader, an Iowa-based Christian conservative advocacy organization. Pence, Noem, and Pompeo are all possible Republican presidential candidates for 2024, likely depending on whether former President Donald Trump decides to run again. And they took turns lambasting President Joe Biden's administration. "The damage that they've done to this country in such a short period of time," Pence lamented during his remarks. Noem talked about recently becoming a grandmother for the first time and offered her own lament. "I really hate the America that we're giving her new granddaughter," Noem said. "I don't recognize the country that I had an opportunity to grow up in." Noem asserted that she has been attacked by liberals and the media for her state's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, not unlike messaging often heard by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, who also spoke at Friday's event and upon whom Noem heaped praise. Noam said that she provided information about the virus to South Dakotans and allowed them to use their personal responsibility. She claimed that track protected the public health and allowed South Dakota to keep its doors open. Despite its geographically sparse population, South Dakota had the nation's 10th highest rate of COVID deaths per population, according to federal data. South Dakota is an incredible spot today, Noam said. Noam and Pence both hammered on popular issues among conservatives, including opposition to critical race theory, the teaching that racism is embedded in many of American systems, and support for law enforcement. Pence offered an accusation that was similar to and equally misleading as one made recently in Iowa's fellow possible presidential candidates Nikki Haley. Quote, critical race theory teaches children as young as kindergarten to be ashamed of their skin color, Pence said. Critical race theory is typically taught in advanced college-level curriculum, not in K-12 schools, and the teaching centers on the idea that racism is systematic in some of the nation's institutions. It does not, as conservatives like Haley and Pence have alleged, teach that all white Americans are racist. Pence said that he is optimistic conservatives will rebound like they did after the 2008 election of Democratic President Barack Obama and then Vice President Biden. Pence noted the gains Republicans made over the following five election cycles from 2010 through 2018. We've seen this movie before, Pence said. We're going to do that again in the next 3.5 years. Iowa Democrats issued a statement on the Family Leaders event accusing the organization of having an anti-LGBTQ agenda and brought attention to the child care tax credit payments approved by Biden and congressional Democrats that began hitting families' bank accounts Thursday. Iowa Democrats are focused on providing relief that will lift up a generation and set Iowa's children up for success, Ross Wilburn, state chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party, said in a statement. The family leader does not stand for all Iowa families. Iowa Democrats will continue to support legislation that improves the lives of all families, no matter what they look like. Now on to the article, Iowa Duo Deny Any Involvement in Molly Tibbetts' Death. Two childhood friends, named by defense lawyers as alternate suspects in the killing of University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts, said Friday they had nothing to do with the crime. Lawyers for Christiana Bahena Rivera, the man convicted of killing Tibbetts, named Gavin Jones and Dalton Hansen as perhaps responsible for Tibbetts' 2018 stabbing death in court filings last week. They made that assertion after inmate Arne Maki came forward in May to say Jones told him that Jones and Hansen killed Tibbetts after she was kidnapped and briefly held at a home used for sex trafficking. Jones' ex-girlfriend came forward independently the same day to say that Jones, 21, also told her he killed Tibbetts. A prosecutor said in court Thursday that there is zero evidence to substantiate Jones' alleged confessions, and that there should be no doubt that Bahena Rivera killed Tibbetts. Reached by phone separately Friday, the Associated Press, Jones and Hansen said that they had no involvement in Tibbetts' disappearance from her hometown of Brooklyn, about 50 miles west of Iowa City, or her violent death. They said they hadn't spoken with investigators, but were eager to do so in order to clear their names. The cops haven't talked to me. No one has talked to me. You are the first person that has called me, said Jones of Oskaloosa. I wasn't involved in anything. I have alibs and everything. I am just waiting for someone to come talk to me. He ended the interview without answering whether he had made a prior statement about Tibbetts' death. The 24-year-old Hansen of Signory said allegations he was involved in Tibbetts' death are crazy and starting to spread online. I have no clue why my name even got brought up in all this, Hansen said. Jurors convicted Bahena Rivera in May after a 2-week trial during which prosecutors argued that the 27-year-old farmhand stalked and approached Tibbetts while she was out for an evening run. They said he killed her after she threatened to call police and dumped her body in a cornfield. Bahena Rivera claimed in his courtroom testimony that the two masked men broke into his trailer and forced him to drive them around at gunpoint. He said they came upon Tibbetts and that one of them stabbed her to death and loaded her body into his car trunk before instructing him to dispose of it. Maki and Jones' ex-girlfriend came forward later that day to tell authorities about Jones' alleged confessions, which Maki thought were bluster until he heard Bahena Rivera's testimony. The defense argues their testimony could have changed the guilty verdict and that Judge Yoel Yates agreed to delay Bahena Rivera's sentencing while he considers whether to order a new trial. Yates, on Friday, denied the defense request to order prosecutors to turn over information about prior sex trafficking investigations in the area, saying that that'd be nothing more than a fishing expedition. Hansen said that he and Jones grew up together in the small town of Signory and were friends off and on until about 2 years ago. He said that, like Jones, he was housed at the Keokuk Jail County in the same time as Maki, but didn't know him well. Hansen and Jones both said that they had never heard of a 50-year-old man who defense lawyers have suggested may have also been involved in the case. Bahena Rivera attorney Chad Fressy said he wasn't surprised by the denials and noted Jones and Hansen have criminal records involving other violent crimes. They aren't going to stand up and say they did it, he said. Now on to a different article. Preliminary data says that 26 tornadoes swept Iowa on Wednesday. Preliminary data shows more than two dozen tornadoes tore across Iowa on Wednesday, according to the National Weather Service. The service said in a tweet Friday that it appears 26 tornadoes touched down in the state Wednesday. If that number holds true, it would be the third most tornadoes in a single day to hit a state since 1980, behind the 35 record on August 31, 2014, and the 28 recorded on April 11, 2001. The number could change as the crew continues to gather more data from Wednesday's storms over the coming days. The Weather Service said, no death or injuries were reported from Wednesday's tornadoes, which touched down in mostly rural, uninhabited areas. But officials said the twisters damaged several buildings, shredding trees, power lines, and overturned vehicles. At least one of the tornadoes, Wednesday, in Calhoun County, was rated an EF3, putting its winds between 136 and 165 miles per hour. That twister skirted the south side of Lake City, ripping parts of roofs and doors off of South Central Calhoun High School building that houses school buses. The NWS reported that tornadoes in Shell Rock and Waverly and Dysart areas were all EF1 storms. Now let's move on to the article. Waterloo and Cedar Falls Symphony returns to Concert Hall with a bang in September. Go for it. That was the attitude at the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra when it came to planning the first half of its upcoming season, said Executive Director Rich Fervert. The first half of the season opens with an out-of-this-world theme in September and ends with a performance by Iowa's own American Idol Matty Poppy on New Year's Eve. In the later half, the orchestra will provide accompaniment for a National Geographic film documentary, Jane, and showcase a multimedia collaboration with Gary Kelly featuring Iowa's blues legend Kevin Birch and cellist Isaac Pastor Chermark. We wanted to come back with a bang, said Ferbert. This series of concerts has really fun and uplifting programs, and Matty Poppy fits perfectly into that. The success she's had and her willingness to remember the Cedar Valley. We hope people are as excited about coming back to live concerts as we are. The opening concert, September 18th, signals a return to the Great Hall stage at the Gallagher Bluedorn Performing Arts Center and features a constellation of music by John Williams' latest Star Wars trilogy, Richard Strauss's also Sprach Zarathustra, and a new work by Augusta Reed Thomas. There's something special about hearing an orchestra play, a large group of people working together and playing unbelievably grandiose music. That's why we've been missing it the last 1.5 years, Jason Weinberger said, conductor at the Pauline Barrett Artistic Director. On October 16th, the orchestra returns to Brown Derby Ballroom in downtown Waterloo with a smaller ensemble for a concert pair at least 4 and 7 p.m. The program will feature Vinyas party music by Mozart and contemporaries including Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little night music, with its Lost Dance movement. For Halloween, Villains and Superheroes at 7 p.m. October 30th at the Gallagher Blue Door will feature music from the Superman and Marvel films along with orchestral epics by Tchaikovsky, Stravinsky, Mozart, and others. It seems that in popular entertainment, classical music is always associated with the bad guys, so we'll try to unwind why and how the tradition of classical music is such a big influence. The bold, brash, orchestral style of writing for concert halls moved right into the movies in such a good connection, said Weinberger. A hometown talent with national celebrity, Clarksville's own Matty Poppy headlines the New Year's Eve Pops concert at 8 p.m. December 31st at the Gallagher Blue Dorn. Poppy will be accompanied in new orchestral arrangements, selections from Nutcracker Suite and holiday favorites such as Sleigh Ride and A Charlie Brown Christmas are on the program too. It's nice to mix it up a bit, and an incredible opportunity for us to show people what we do. Maddie will be performing along with the orchestra and doing some solo work, and we'll play music appropriate for the season and the setting, Weinberger said. The season's second half opens with Jane, the Nat Geo documentary about chimpanzee conservationist Jane Goodall, with the orchestra performing music composed by Philip Glass. The March 12th concert was originally scheduled for April 2020, but was canceled due to the pandemic. On May 26th, Gary Kelly's intimate multimedia presentation will weave together the music of Bach and Robert Johnson, featuring Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony principal cello Isaac Pastor Chermark and blues guitarist Kevin Burt. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony will also serve as pit orchestra for Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in three performances in April. The show is a collaborative production with the orchestra, the Gallagher Blue Dorn, University of Northern Iowa School of Music, Waterloo Community Playhouse, and Cedar Falls Community Theater. The performance is not part of the symphony's season. Tickets are available at www.wcfsymphony.org. or at Unit IX at 273-4849, or by calling the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony at 273-3373. Now on to another music article. North End's Arts and Music Festival includes gospel music, drill teams, hip-hop, and a parade. Felicia Smith-Nells expects a reunion-ish feeling among festival-goers at the 11th North End Arts and Music Festival on Friday and Saturday. It's like, I'm excited to see the family and gather everyone together again. I think everyone is excited at being able to share again. The festival chair said, people can attend for free, so just come and enjoy the art and music. And with the parade feeding into the festival, it's going to be an exciting weekend. The celebration begins Friday at a gospel music kickoff at 7 p.m. at the East High School Auditorium. Gospel artist Kenesha Davis will be featured, and Gabe Evans is the opening act. Davis has been performing in the world premiere musical The Suffragist at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center in Cedar Falls. More than 13 drill teams from across the country will participate in the Summer Soul Parade beginning at 10 a.m. Saturday. The parade will also feature entries from the local businesses and organizations. The level of talent of these African-American teams, the precision, the polish, and costuming is amazing. It's important not just for the black community, but for the community as a whole to see this level of excellence, Smith-Nalls said. The parade will begin on the corner of the East 4th and Donald Street, proceeded down East 4th Street and turn left on Newell Street. Right on Mobile Street, left on Odea Street, and ending on Ferguson Fields Park, where the festival takes place. It's important for this festival to be in Neighborhood Park. It started 11 years ago in a parking lot at Jubilee United Methodist Church. We want people to see what North End has to offer and to keep the focus on the talents and the arts of the people here and the neighborhood, Smith-Nalls said. Opening ceremonies are at noon Saturday at Ferguson Fields Park, where the youth art team will have a display as well as local artists, vendors, and nonprofit organizations. There will be activities for children and adults. Food vendors will be set up. Performers will include hip-hop literacy at 12 p.m., followed by at 1 p.m. by Daniel Mitchell, and at 1:30 p.m. by Hart Smith. Nubia Sana takes the stage at 3 p.m., followed by 4 p.m. by Brooklyn Smith, and at 5 p.m., Flava. Those attending are encouraged to bring lawn chairs and blankets. People who have not received the COVID-19 vaccination are asked to wear face masks. Hand-washing stations will be set up. More vendors are being sought. Contact Smith-Nalls at 319-529-4911. Sponsors are the North End Arts and Culture Center, Blackhawk County Gaming Association, and CUNA Mutual Group. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Wayne W. Berger. Wayne W. Berger, 95, of Waterloo, died Saturday, July 17th at Ravenwood Specialty Care. He was born October 26, 1925, in rural Fox Township in Black Hawk County, and the son of Albert A. and Anna F. Arnand Berger. Wayne graduated from Sacred Heart High School in 1944 and served in the United States Air Force during World War II. He was employed as a plumber by numerous Waterloo plumbing contractors, also served as a plumbing inspector for the city of Waterloo for 25 years, retiring on January 5, 1988. Survivors include his son, Wayne W. Berger II of Cedar Falls, and several nieces and nephews, preceded in death by his parents, his sister, and brother-in-law, Theodora and Melvin Bruskern. Mass of Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 21st at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Full military rites will be conducted by Evansdale AMVETS Post 31, assisted by the United States Naval Honor Guard. Public visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 20th at Hargity Wachoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 4 p.m. rosary. Visitation also 1 hour prior to services Wednesday at the church. Memorials may be directed to Sacred Heart Catholic Church, and online condolences may be left at www.haggertywaychoffgroup.com. Betty Jean Brunchion. Betty Jean Brunchion was born December 31, 1927 in Bremer County, Iowa, daughter of Chancey and Bertha Schauer Myers. She attended county schools in Bremer County. Betty was united in marriage to Eugene Buster Brunchion on July 27, 1947, at Trinity Lutheran Church. He preceded her in death on July 9, 1985. She worked as a clerk at a S&S grocery and food demonstrator, retiring in 1990. Betty enjoyed cooking, playing cards, and she was an avid reader and loved her grandchildren. She lived in Waterloo most her life, later moving to Charles City. Betty passed away on Tuesday, July 13, 2021, at New Aldea Lifescapes at the age of 93. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband, five brothers, Ivan, Robert, Donald, Alvin, and Gerald Myers, and three sisters, Grace Brown, Dorothy Dunwald, and Lavone Meehan. Betty is survived by her three sons, Larry Brunchion of Alleman, Ronnie Brunchion of Fredericksburg, and Thomas Brunchion of Waterloo, a daughter, Deborah Mitchell Thompson of Snohomish, Wisconsin, and 16 grandchildren, 36 great-grandchildren, 4 great-great-grandchildren, and a sister, Helen McCulley of Tudson. Memorials may be directed to the family. Visitation will be Monday, July 19th at Messiah Lutheran Church, 705 3rd Street, Charles City, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., with services following. Burial at Garden of Memories at a later date. Parrott and Wood is handling the arrangements. Their phone number is 319-232-3235. Condolences may be left at www.parrottandwood.com. Raymond William Randall. Raymond William Randall, 88, of LaPorte City, Iowa, died Thursday, July 1st, 2021, at his home in his sleep. A funeral service will take place at 2 p.m. on Sunday, July 25th, 2021, at Murdoch Lindwin Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial is Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Randall at www.murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Bert Dean Whitney. Born in Waterloo, Iowa on March 18, 1961, passed away on May 26, 2021 at Allen Hospital Hospice. Survived by his mother, Betty Strubel of Waterloo, Iowa. Brother Bill and Carla at Art Menko from California. Sisters Kathy Strubel of LaPorte City. Brother Bob from Waterloo. Four stepsisters, Pam from Michigan, Deb Hughes from Texas, and Karen Olson from Wisconsin, and Becky Dorscheid from Minnesota. Many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his father, Lewis Dean Whitney. He graduated from Baraboo High School in Baraboo, Wisconsin. He was employed by the Medicom for over 20 years. Bert was a compassionate soul with a heart of gold. He was an active member with Prairie View Lakes Church in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He enjoyed fishing and hunting and would travel anywhere in the country to pursue his passion. He also enjoyed riding his motorcycle and mule with family and friends. No services are being planned at this time. Now, let's move over to some sports articles, starting with Visacki holds two-shot lead at Waterloo Open. Michael Visacki woke up Saturday morning holding a one-shot lead over BJ Doucette and Nathan Yankovic in the 88th Waterloo Open at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course. The Sarasota, Florida golfer will wake up on Sunday with an even bigger lead over Yankovic as the final round of the professional division concludes. Three golfers, Doucette, Rancho Santa Margarita from California, Patrick Williams from Aresto, Florida, and Ethan Brew of Perioro, Illinois, are three shots behind, but are still in the hunt for the $50,000 winner's purse. The total purse is just over $137,000, with 126 pro golfers vying for a piece of that. Visacki teed off in the first group at 6:55 a.m. When his round was finished, he had an increased lead over Yankovic. He had increased his lead to two strokes, with half the golfers still out on the course waiting to tee off. For Visacki, consistency was the key to leading the tournament with an 18 under 126. "I look for consistency in all parts of my game," Visacki said. "I played solid golf. I struggled on the first nine holes, but after the turn, I said it's a new nine and I needed that to forget the first nine and just played consistent golf the rest of the way." That worked for Visacki, who birdied just one hole in the front nine, then caught fire and made seven birdies on the back nine to finish 8 under for the day. Hailing from Florida, Visacki said that he was just getting used to playing northern golf and that he has felt comfortable playing in Waterloo this week. But he said that he's not resting on his laurels as he has one more day to play consistently. "My approach tomorrow will be like I'm chasing," he said. "I need to stay consistent and play good golf." Many who follow professional golf and PGA Tour might remember Visacki from a video that went viral in April. After making the cut for the Valspar Championship in Palm Harbor, Florida, Visacki made an emotional call home to his parents to tell the news. In the video, Visacki became choked up as he tells his dad, "I made it." That, in turn, made his father very emotional as Visacki and his family have struggled to keep times together, have struggled at times to keep the younger golfer in the game. It was Visacki's first time qualifying for a PGA event. In May, he qualified for his second PGA tournament, the Charles Schwab Challenge. "Just a lot of people give up on their dreams, probably because they can't afford it," Visacki said in a press conference at the Valspar Championship. "But I have been lucky enough to be with my parents. I have been able to help me out sometimes to keep living it." Yankovic finished 7 under for the day, losing one stroke to the day one leader. The Blacklick, Ohio golfer started the day with 3 birdies on the first 4 holes, but slipped a bit on the par 4, number 14, with a double bogey. He also bogeyed a hole on his back 9, which could have cut the deficit to just 1 stroke after 2 rounds. Doucette lost 2 strokes to leader on Saturday, but still feels he has a good chance to win the tournament. My game plan will be the same, he said after his 6-under 66 on Saturday. I played aggressively to my sport today, to my spots today, and won't change much up for tomorrow. I need to stay aggressive but not get stupid. Musette had an opportunity to go into the final round tied with Yankovic, just 2 shots behind, but missed a 5-footer for birdie number 18. He took the miss in stride. You can't put more weight on any one shot, he said. I made a 15-footer on the hole before. On that last putt, I had a good look but just missed it. That's golf. Of the 126 golfers who started the professional tournament, 55 made the cut with a 7-under or better. Now there's a subheader, double aces. David Lawrence, a teaching pro in Davenport, hit a hole in one at an unlikely hole on any other day. The Moline, Illinois golfer aced the 314-yard par 4 11th hole after hitting over water and bouncing onto the green before losing sight of his ball. The hole was playing slightly downwind, so that was the only reason I went for it today, Lawrence said. I hit it as good as I possibly could. I picked up my tee and saw the ball bounce, and then I saw the guys on the 15th fairway raise their hands. What a feeling. The second hole in one of the day came on number 8 when Grant Brown from Lawton, Oklahoma, holed his tee shot on the 207-yard par 3 hole. Now on to another golf article. This time it's about amateur golf. Close battle expected as amateurs head into final day. Trent Lindemann set the number early Saturday on day 2 of the Waterloo Open Amateur Division at South Hills Golf Course. Glenn Walls was the only one who couldn't match it. Lindemann, who played golf at Simpson College, rode a second day best round of 67 to a 2-round score of 137, while Walls, the former University of Northern Iowa standout, followed his opening day 69 with a 68 to grab a share of the lead leading into Sunday's final at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course. Those two led a group of 36 golfers who made the cut and will play with the professionals in the final round. I think I just stayed committed to my shots, said Lindemann, whose day featured 3 birdies on both nines and just 1 bogey. I got the putter going pretty early and hit some good wedges shots into a couple of holes, so that helped. I would honestly say right off that the number one tee I hit a good drive and hit a good second shot, and when you do those two things first, it really gets you going. Lindemann had good feeling about Saturday's tour on South Hills after Friday's opening round at Gates Park. The greens were a little slower yesterday, he said. I left a lot out there, but today, with the early morning tee time and the weather conditions, and the fact that I practiced here on Thursday, I knew the greens would be pretty good. Walls was a part of a foursome that featured Friday's leader, former Panther teammate Braden Gall. While Gall took a few holes to get going Saturday before battling back on the back nine for a 73, Walls started with birdies on the first 3 holes. The only blemish on his card was a bogey on the par 4 14th hole. I birdied 1 and 3 and got rolling early, he said. Then I got a birdie on 7 and birdied 9. Shooting 32 on the front is always nice. I didn't make anything on the back, but all in all, it was a good day for sure. Walls has always enjoyed playing at South Hills, even though it requires a long trip from Colorado these days. I had a 65 out here and a couple of 68s, he noted. It's been a course I typically play well at, and I kind of kept it going today. I enjoyed playing with my good buddy Brendan Gao. I come back and get to spend some time with some college friends and people I met in Cedar Falls. Gao is tied in 8th at 141. Hot on the leader's heels is Davenport's Dusty Drenth, the 2018 Amateur Division Champion, and a player who always seems to be in contention. Playing in the day's final group, he fired his second consecutive 69 Saturday and is 1 shot behind. I could have played a little bit better on the back, said Drenth, after a round that ended at 8:10 p.m. I bogeyed 18. That pine tree gets me sometimes, but yeah, if you told me I'd shoot 69 today, I probably would have taken it. Drenth said his putter and his irons served him well Saturday. He drained a 25-foot putt on number 12 for a birdie, but then missed a 6-footer on the 13th for another birdie. "It evens out in the game," he said. Like Walls, Drenth always likes his chances at South Hills. "When I was 13 years old, I shot a 66 on this golf course and won a major and won a junior tournament." He related, I shot really low rounds here, and so a 69 is almost like par here. I've always liked this golf course. It seems to fit my game well." Drenth has played the Open for the past 10 years, often in a group that includes his father, Mark, for the first 2 days. "My dad's still a stud," he said Dusty. "He's 61 and he shot 72 today." That foursome also included Kevin Ault, who is 2 shots back at 139 after a 68 Saturday, and Michael Fastart, who is at 141. "I'd like to sign up with good players," said Drenth. "Michael and I went to Chambers Bay for the U.S. 4 ball earlier this year, as did Walls and Gall. He is one of my good friends, and it's nice to have him tag along and play with me. It absolutely helps to play with good players." The group at 140, 3 shots behind, consists of Muzzy Dahu of North Oaks, Minnesota, Iowa State freshman Brock Barnhart, and Logan Schweinevus of Osein, who made a big move up the leaderboard with a 68 Saturday and was fueled by a back 9 32. Other top scorers Saturday included 68 by Trevor Lay of Kianawani, Illinois, and Tyler Sansgaard of Nevada, and Jack Ebner of Idna, Minnesota. Lay's round was highlighted by an eagle number 13. Waterloo's Casey Doland powered his way into contention as well with a 69 after an opening round 74. Joe Bates of Albia took over the senior division and led with 140 total. He leads Friday's leader Jay Slings by 2 shots. Slings carded a brilliant 66 Friday at Gates despite one double bogey. The top 8 seniors move on to play at Irv Warren. Pat Ryan of Marshalltown holds a 1-shot edge over Steve Collar of Marion in the super senior division, 144 to 145. They are 2 of the 4 who advance to play Sunday. Making it to Irv Warren is what it's all about for many of the amateur division players. "It's always a goal to get to Sunday," said Lindenman. "Irv Warren's a great course. It's a birdie fest. Just look at the pro scores. It's fun." Now on to the article, DiBenedetto could be out of cup options after losing Ryde. Always a popular driver, Matt DiBenedetto won a fan vote this season that earned him the final spot in NASCAR's All-Star race. As for the rest of his racing career, well, wins haven't come at all. DiBenedetto became a fan favorite over his 7-year career as the underdog of underfunded teams. He qualified for his first Daytona 500 in 2016 with an open car, who just needed top-tier equipment to prove that he could compete with the stars of the sport and even win a race or two. When he got that shot last year with Wood Brothers Racing, steady success instead never came, and DiBenedetto is now without a ride for next season. DiBenedetto has no idea what's next. He could not hide the crushing hurt in a nine-minute video he posted on social media, where he vented his frustrations at losing yet another ride. "I'm here to win in the Cup Series," he said. "I'm going to. Time could be running short." DiBenedetto had known since October he was losing his ride in the number 21 Ford at the end of the season, but perhaps false hopes of his reprieve grew when Brad Keselowski decided to leave Team Penske for Rough Runway Racing. Austin Cindric was also slotted for the ride at Wood Brothers, which essentially operates as a fourth Penske car, but got the nod instead to replace Keselowski. DiBenedetto's seat will now go to Xfinity Series driver Harrison Burton. Wood Brothers co-owner Eddie Wood said that he wanted a rookie to team up with Cindric as NASCAR ushers in a new car in 2022. "Those two guys could work together and develop themselves into great race car drivers," Wood said. "Being rookies, they're both on the same level, and this new car is such a sweet And this new car is such a white sheet of paper that even if you're a veteran, if you're a 20-year veteran, you're really not going to have a lot on a rookie. DiBenedetto had held out hope that Keselowski's departure gave him a chance to keep his ride, but in the end, the statistics didn't support his cause. Although he did qualify for the playoffs last year, for the first time, he's winless and has just 27 top 10 finishes and 233 career starts. At the track, where the winner gets a lobster, DiBenedetto had an outside chance to claw his way into the playoffs picture beginning Sunday at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. "In our eyes, we're not done," Wood said. "There are five races left before the playoffs. We're going to win a race and get into the playoffs." DiBenedetto will hit the free agent market without a sponsor, and minus the funding necessary to entice a team owner to take him, he could be sitting out the Cup Series in 2022. DiBenedetto said this week that he didn't want to drop down to the second-tier Xfinity Series or drive in the Truck Series. The number 21 team made the crew chief change in June with Jonathan Hassler taking over from Greg Irwin, which resulted in modest improvement. DiBenedetto finished 10th and 9th in his last two races. "Our team is clicking," DiBenedetto said. "Finally, but guess what? It's too late. I know it's going to work out like it's supposed to, but I'm just expressing my frustration with the way it is." So where could he go? There are a few options, with most seats for 2022 already secured. 23XI Racing has discussed adding a second car, and 2004 champion Kurt Busch, last week's winner at Atlanta, could be in the mix for that spot. Richard Petty Motorsports has yet to pick up the option on Eric Jones's contract. GMS Racing is making the move from the Truck Series to Cup in 2022, and Colleg Racing might have a spot open, leaving a door cracked for DiBenedetto. Kez on the move. Keselowski, the defending New Hampshire race winner, is trying to win one more lobster for team owner Roger Penske. Keselowski and Penske officially confirmed this week that they were splitting up at the end of the season. Sindik was named driver on the flagship number 2 for 2022. Keselowski left because he wanted an ownership stake in his race team. Roush Fenway Racing announced it had scheduled a major announcement next week regarding the team's plan for the future. At the NASCAR Hall of Fame, and Keselowski should be named driver and part of owner on Tuesday. Keselowski is set to become the latest active or recently retired driver with an ownership stake, joining Denny Hamlin and Justin Marks, among others. "I think that these drivers don't want to drive forever," Penske said. "They want to have equity. They have knowledge, and I think the team's owners and other people do. So I think it's a changing of the guard, maybe, in the industry." And now onto a subheader that says Pitbull's activism. Pitbull, co-owner of Trackhouse Racing, will place decals of the Cuban flag and the words "Support Freedom" in both English and Spanish on the number 99 Chevrolet driven by Daniel Suarez. Pitbull, the Cuban-American entertainer, asked people to stand up, step up, their support in the wake of protests that erupted last week in Cuba. Many expressed anger over long lines and shortages of food and medicines, as well as repeated electricity outages. Some have demanded a faster-paced vaccination against COVID-19. Another subheader, Odds and Ends. Denny Hamlin and Kyle Larson are 5-1 favorites to win Sunday, according to FanDuel Sportsbook. Kyle Busch, at 7-1, starts on the pole. New Hampshire, which used to have two NASCAR weekends, is running its 50th Cup race. Joe Gibbs Racing has finished first or second in 14 in the last 15 races. Now let's move on to our final article today, U.S. Women Hunt Gold to Pair with World Cup Title. The United States women's national soccer team has something to prove at the Tokyo Olympics. It's not so much about revenge after a surprising loss to Sweden at the 2016 Rio Games, but rather a new goal. The U.S. can become the first team to win an Olympics following a World Cup victory. The Americans will play in Tokyo for the first World Championship under coach Vlado Andonovski. His immensely deep and talented squad includes the sport's biggest names, Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Christian Press, and Carly Lloyd. The US team, winner of the 2019 World Cup in France, is ranked number one in the world. It is undefeated in 42 straight matches and shows no sign of slowing down heading into the 2023 World Cup. The biggest hurdle along that path will be the Olympics, where a small roster, condensed schedule, and the hot and humid conditions will all be challenges, along with the competition. Andonovski emphasized versatility in choosing his squad for Tokyo. Experience counted too, with the average age of the team at 30.8 years old, the oldest U.S. Olympic roster ever. 17 of the 18 players were on the World Cup squad. There's so many boxes that the players need to check in order to make the roster, starting from health and fitness, that's very important, performance. They've got to perform. It doesn't matter if they're versatile if they don't perform well. So there's a certain level of performance that they need to have, or a certain way that they need to execute the task, Andonovski said. And then obviously, the experience that they have, they've already been on this team in big tournaments. The United States in Group G will open with the nemesis Sweden in Tokyo on July 21st. Sweden knocked out the Americans in the quarterfinals on penalties in Brazil, which goalkeeper Hope Solo famously called the Swedes cowards for bunkering in on defense. One of Sweden's advantages in 2016 was coach Pia Sundhage, who was the former U.S. coach and knew her former team and its weakness as well. She's now a coach at Brazil, while Sweden is led by Peter Gerhardsson. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, July 18th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.